I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Take a moment to think about your town. Do you love it? Really love it? Today we discover why we do or don't become so emotionally attached to where we live. A place can offer all the big ticket items, but that doesn't mean you'll fall for it. More often, it's the little things that make a city lovable. Then we meet one son of Dodge City who moved away from his town to join academia. I'll ask him about the memories he took with him, about growing up on the range, and we'll find out why he can't stop writing about them. Later, we'll have the latest edition of Statehouse Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. How much of your emotional identity is tied up in your city? If you're faced with leaving it tomorrow, could you go without a second thought, or would you admit that you love it too much to leave it? Whether we love our towns and what that love could mean for them is something that Peter Kajiyama spends a lot of time studying and teaching. He's a community development consultant and the author of two books, For the Love of Cities, The Love Affair Between People and Their Places, and the follow-up, Love Where You Live, Creating Emotionally Engaging Places. He joins me from the studios of WUSF in Tampa Bay, Florida, which means he's in a far better place than I am this morning. And so good to have you, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah, good morning, Steve.
One of the things you point out in one of your TEDx talks is that a city gets very little return for doing, you know, the big things like filling every pothole. Instead, you say the things we love about places are small things. And I'm wondering, like what?
Well, I call them love notes. They're essentially those small little touches that actually seem to have more value to us than, say, fixing potholes, which is not to say fixing potholes isn't important, but think about it. We expect our leaders in our cities to fix the potholes. You know, we expect police and fire service to work. What we don't necessarily expect are those moments of beauty, art, great design there. So a good example might be public art. A mural that actually makes you stop for a second in the midst of, you know, while you're sitting in traffic or while you're walking down a street and you pause and you look down an alley that otherwise you probably would not have even bothered to notice. Like, that is one of those little things that changes the fundamental way that we feel about our place. Like, hey, that's cool. That's beautiful. That makes me feel a little bit different than that. You know, a farmer's market is a good example of a small thing in comparison to a city, but those things tend to have real resonance with citizens.
So, Peter, why is it that it's the small things that we become emotionally attached to?
Well, I think it's because the connection is more tangible. While we feel a connection to our airport when we travel there, while we feel a connection to the, you know, a big building, we may work in that. The fact is that we feel far closer to our neighborhood, which means the community garden that's there, the dog park, the playground where our kids, you know, go and play. We feel that's personal there. It's the little local restaurant. It's the coffee shop versus, you know, something that's just seems beyond us there. I think it has to do with scale, which explains why certain architecture reflects a more intimate sort of feeling, and others is very dehumanizing and makes us in turn feel very small.
You know, it's interesting. I love the Tivoli, which is an old theater in Westport with these lousy seats that shows all these great independent films. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how does that wind up translating then to, you know, a bigger love for the entire city?
Well, sure. I mean, if you go to the Tivoli and you have a good experience, it's like all of a sudden now you walk out of the theater, you're in a good mood. It's like, hey, I just saw a really cool movie. It's like, hey, you want to grab some dessert? You go to the restaurant down the street, or maybe you had dinner beforehand. You lead up to that day because you know the Tivoli is going to be is cool and you enjoy going there. So the whole experience of from the time you leave your house to the time you return, I would suggest you're probably going to be in a fairly good mood. So I think those things, that Tivoli then has this halo effect, you know, in that whole neighborhood that it touches there. And by extension, the city, you know, writ large, because again, if you go there, you have a good experience and you say, hey, I really like this place. This feels like home. to me. That's going to, you know, foment your emotional connection to your broader place.
We're talking with community development consultant Peter Kajiyama about why we love the cities and the way that we do. You know, you tout play along the same lines of the Tivoli, Peter. You tout play as the bedrock of our deep emotional relationships. Give us an example of how that shows itself in a city.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if you think about play as it relates to our personal relationships, those unstructured, unplanned moments when you're hanging out with your friends and family at play, those are some of the bedrock moments or elements of our relationships with our other people. Well, we're in this relationship with our cities, so we need opportunities to play with our cities as well. And I think public art, coming back to that again, is one of those great ways where that can kind of happen. And a good example of that, you know, on a macro level would be like Millennium Park in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, sure. People love, you know, Cloud Gate. It's very fun. It's like a giant funhouse mirror. But you notice there's also those two giant water towers that have the water cannons that basically it's a water feature. And you'll see hundreds of kids playing in there. And I know downtown there in Overland Park next to their downtown and next to their farmer's market, there's a very small little splash pad there. But that, I'm told, is, you know, I was there in January. So, but I'm told that during the summer, that is one of the most popular spots on a weekend, because the parents come down, they sit at the benches, they let their kids play in the water. That is play. That is playing with your city. You don't necessarily recognize it as playing with the city. You think, I'm just having fun in this water feature. Well, that water feature, you know, it came to you courtesy of the downtown group or the city writ large or the, you know, a park that you go and have that sort of same experience, you know, play where we're smiling, and we're not even thinking about this other stuff there. But that is, as I say, one of the bedrocks of our relationships with our places.
You know, in Kansas City, we have the shuttlecocks outside the big art gallery here, the big art museum, the Nelson Atkins. And, you know, for a lot of people, that's become this emotional touchstone.
I confess I am not familiar with that. But if there is an opportunity to play with something that, you know, makes people smile and have that interaction, that is an incredible value add. And compared to, you know, the museum as a whole, that's probably a very small expenditure with a pretty large impact, a pretty large return on investment.
There's other things that you cite that make cities lovable, and among them you list rituals and traditions. And I get tradition. You know, we've got them here. You know, there's the Royal Barbecue Contest, the St. Patty's Day Parade. But what makes something a ritual, Peter?
I think it's when we elevate it to something beyond just, you know, something we do every year. You know, every year we do, you know, we do a 4th of July thing. We do
you hear people say that all the time. Every year we do this. Yeah.
Right. But a ritual, we attach, I think, a greater significance to it. And the prime example that I used when I wrote about that in the first book was a water fire in Providence, Rhode Island. And it's this amazing ritual, and they've done it for over 25 years. They have these braziers that are anchored in the middle of their river in their downtown.
We do something like that here, too. Yeah, exactly.
I imagine it was inspired by water fire, because there's been a lot of people who've copied that. But when they do those water fire events, and they do a couple dozen of them a year, it is the whole city takes on this, you know, downtown gets excited. It's like, hey, water fire's happening tonight. And people will come down, and the fires are lit, and people smell the smoke, and they hear the crackle of the wood, and there's these shadows that are created all over the city, and there's music, and they're usually themed. It's like, this feels, this is special there. And so I think it's when we take a good event, and maybe how do we elevate it into something even more, that's when it becomes more significant and becomes that community ritual.
Something else that makes cities lovable that you cite, a bike-friendly city. You know, we're starting to catch up on that front. How does that make a city lovable?
Well, anytime we can get out of our cars and interact with our environment, you know, so then when we're not surrounded by the vehicle, that's a good thing. You know, cars isolate us. And, you know, cars, I think, are probably, our drives are probably the most stressful parts of our day, you know, the daily commute. Apologies to those of you who are sitting in traffic listening to this right now. I hate to remind you that. But when we get out of the car, like when we're riding a bike, we feel more free. We see the city in a different way. We're traveling at a different speed. You know, we're looking at different things there. And same thing with walking. Walking allows you to improvise and to discover things that you probably otherwise wouldn't have, you know, bothered to notice at 45 miles an hour. So again, anything that gets us out of the car, that's a good thing for helping us reconnect with our city.
We're talking about this notion that little things are what really draw people and attach people to a city. And I'm wondering, what are some of the little things in the Kansas City Metro that you find so appealing? Our number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Here's another one, another thing that makes a city so lovable, Peter, that you talk about, a walkable city. You've alluded to this already, is a lovable city because why?
Why? Again, when we walk, we are free to, we're at our leisure to look at different things, to go into a store that we otherwise wouldn't have even, you know, never saw that before, to smell the, you know, out of a restaurant, say, hey, they're making, you know, something really good is coming out of there. So walking allows us to interact with our environment in a completely different way. And again, some parts, you know, it's hard to make entire cities walkable. You know, we are not Europe in that sense. So we try to make certain parts of our cities walkable. Certainly downtowns become sort of the obvious points, you know, where we try to reemphasize and rediscover design that is based upon walking instead of cars. There, because again, there is something about when we are physically not isolated, we have to deal. You know, we look each other, you know, in the eye. We smile. We occasionally say hello there, or you might just run into somebody you know. How cool is that? Mm-hmm. There, those moments of that serendipitous, you know, event like that. That is that's one of those things that definitely makes you smile, and you go, wow, that was cool.
I remember when my kids were little, the neighbors and my wife and I would take our kids up to the top floor of the student union at UMKC and late at night, and you can see the front lawn of the art gallery, you can see the Country Club Plaza, and it's just absolutely a spectacular, quiet, peaceful place. And the kids would always be running around chattering like crazy until we would get up there, and it would be so quiet and so sort of overwhelming, they would just sort of quiet themselves and sit there for a while and enjoy 5 minutes of peace, and then, of course, all heck would break loose again.
Well, think about it. As human beings, you know, we are endlessly fascinated with just watching each other. You know, that's sort of written into our DNA. So if you can increase the people watching, you know, opportunities in your places, you're going to increase the satisfaction that people are going to have with that. And that goes, again, hand in hand with walking, but it also goes hand in hand with creating those sort of great spaces where people can sit and watch each other.
What are some of the small things about the Kansas City area that you love? 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, one other thing that makes a city lovable, you cite a dog-friendly city helps a whole lot, and I loved your apology for focusing on dogs. You say the reality is we just don't walk our cats, but this gives cities a certain social capital, which is what?
Well, think about it. When we're, you know, dogs force us to actually go out and interact with the environment. We have to walk our dogs, right? And when we walk our dogs, we're actually out there. We're probably going to run into people. And the dog is a natural icebreaker, right? You know, oh, that's a cute dog. What's his name? It's like, oh, or what's her name? Her name's Buffy. It's like, oh, it's very sweet.
Right.
There. And people will talk to each other. They otherwise, you know, if two people pass on the sidewalk, they might grunt something at each other. But, you know, if there's a dog involved, there's a better chance that they might actually engage. And think about the nature of dog parks. Again, dog parks are really, you know, of course the dogs are playing, but people talk to each other at the dog park, right? You know, chances are they don't know each other's names, but they know each other's dogs' names, you know, and eventually they might learn, you know, their fellow citizens' names as well, and that's social capital, and it's because the dogs have essentially broken the ice and negotiated that encounter for you. So yeah, dog parks and dogs are amazing social lubricants.
So what we're talking about here then, if you boil it down, is this notion that these things that make us love our cities are those places where we connect with other people, where we engage our senses in a full sort of way. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah, that's very well said. There, you know, we our day-to-day existence in cities oftentimes is can be kind of rather dull and pedestrian in the sense, you know, we do the same thing over and over again. So those moments when we actually do physically, emotionally, psychologically engage with other people, where we're engaged with our environment in a way that's not just moving from point A to point B, that we're actually looking at something, we're thinking about it, we're experiencing it, those are good moments. And they don't cost a lot of money. These things I'm talking about are very small in the grand scale of, you know, how cities spend money. But the point that I try to make is that we need to be thinking about them as important elements, not just, you know, again, roads and bridges and schools, incredibly important. You know, we got to do that stuff. But these little things, these, you know, and again, small expenditures have very big impacts on the way we ultimately will feel about our places.
You know, this is so cool for me, Peter, because I guess I this has been in the back of my mind for a while, perhaps, but you're articulating it in a way that has got me thinking about my community in a whole different way, and I appreciate that. Let's go to some calls here. Robert from Kansas City, Kansas. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
So one really small thing that I like, my dad always took me there when I was a kid, and, you know, in middle school and high school, we always went there, but it's over by the, I think, the viaduct over by Call Point.
Sure.
It's called the see-through bridge, where you, it's kind of underneath, I think, 670, but you can see through it straight into the Missouri River or Kansas River. I'm not really too sure which one it is. But on that note, also Call Point is something, and as the guy on the panel, I don't know his name, has mentioned, you know, these things don't cost very much money. If anything, they just cost gas, you know, to get there.
There you go. Peter?
And a little time to get there.
And yeah. A little time, yeah.
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 Again, what is the value of a great view? I would say it's actually pretty high there. And again, because obviously, Robert, you remember that. That's a place that you identify with as part of your home. So that's important.
816-235-2888 is the number. Let's go to Francie from the South Plaza neighborhood. Francie, you're on with Peter Kajayama. Good morning.
Good morning. I love Kaufman Gardens at 48th and Rock Hill.
Oh, sure.
It's a great walk from my place to walk along the Brush Creek walking trail. And then the garden, even in the winter, it's just the enclosed, and on a sunny day, the paths are inviting. But mostly the greenhouse area in the winter, it smells like heaven, and right now they have this gorgeous orchid display. It's worth a trip there. It really is.
That's a good one, Francie. I appreciate that one.
And she said smell. Think about that. That's another sense, you know, we don't necessarily think about, what does my city smell like?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it smells like, you know, petrol or something like that. But
yes.
Yeah, you know, having, you know, something like that, it's like, or think about, you know, the park in spring or after a good rainstorm. It's like, it's good stuff.
You know, the element you say that makes for the most lovable cities are the people themselves who love a city. Is that because it can be so contagious?
Well, certainly. Emotions are contagious. You know, when more people start saying they love your community, other people are going to see it, feel it, and believe it. You know, and if you're surrounded by a lot of negativity, that's going to spread there as well. You know, so the challenge for us is, if we want to, you know, see our places get better, is how do we create more positive energy and excitement and positive emotions about our places? Because that, again, will naturally translate, you know, to other people.
I can imagine there are city officials listening to what you've got to say, and they're checking off the list as we go along here. You know, we got the bike lanes, we got the pedestrian sections, we got the dog walkers covered, and they're thinking, we've got to be the most lovable city ever. Are they right?
Well, that's certainly, you know, part of the, you know, this creating a set of conditions. This is not a formula. You know, I talk about this is like, you know, and again, I think cities and elected officials would love it if there was a, it's like,
yes.
Okay, here's the formula.
Right.
You know, do A, B, and C, and boom, you're good. No, this is more like alchemy than it is like chemistry, in the sense that you add a bunch of these elements together, and you might create a lovable place. You're trying to create a set of conditions where love might happen. You know,
so intentionality, you really can't create these small things that you're talking about? I mean, is that more serendipity?
No, you can't. Certainly you can create these small things, these small projects or these little things, but you can't necessarily, you know, gauge how the emotional, you know, response that people might have. It's like, I thought it would be this, but it turns out it was this, you know, there. So, like I said, it's more about creating a set of conditions where this stuff might happen. And I think one of the secret ingredients is, and you brought this up before, it's the people. Because, again, our elected officials have to approach things from a certain sort of, you know, perspective. They are sort of constrained by the things that they can do, certainly. But we as citizens, because we don't see the problem in the same way, we're far more free to come up with solutions that maybe the, you know, the official folks are like, man, I wish we could have done that, but there's no way in heck we could, you know, even manage that. Or it's like, I never even thought of that. So again, when we add that to the mix, you know, the good, you know, good top-down stuff from the government, and then the good, interesting little stuff that we as citizens bring to the table, that's when you have, I think, the near certainty, if you will, of creating a more lovable city.
Joe from Independence, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Joe.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, I want to say one of my favorite little things about Kansas City is the city market, being down there with all the people and buying from the local farmers and artisans, and just being amongst all the people down there and walking around.
Couldn't agree with you more, Joe. That's a great choice. Thanks for calling.
And he's actually calling from Independence. And I know Independence is moving their farmer's market because they realize how important their farmer's market is to their community. And they're doing a much bigger expansion to move it into the heart there of, I guess, it's Independence Square. So, yeah, farmer's markets. Absolutely.
Let's go to Galen from the Rock Hill neighborhood. Galen, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Well, one of the many things I love about Kansas City and Rock Hill in particular is that we have so many great neighborhoods, that many of whom have old houses that have porches that are natural gathering places for people to just get together on a very impromptu basis.
That's a great one. That's a great one, Galen. I like that a lot. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Maria from Kansas City, Missouri. Maria, good morning.
Good morning. Hi. So one thing I really love about Kansas City is, well, there's this one spot that I really like that's right underneath the liquor store on the west side, and I just go down there and I can sleep down there and I can, you know, hang out with my friends and smoke crack.
Well, okay, we're going to leave that one right there. I don't know if that's what you had in mind, Peter, but it's an idea.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, people are going to use public space, you know, the way, you know, they're going to use it. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have spaces for people to sit. You know, I often joke, it's like we make the city uncomfortable for everybody because we're afraid that a small group of people might actually sit down or lie down on something. It's like, I think that's kind of silly. So, you know, so what that woman said, you know, you take that, you have to take that with, you know, creating, you know, great spaces where people actually want to gather. They might do something that maybe you weren't so happy about.
Well, again, Peter, you got me thinking about my area a whole lot differently here. Peter Kajiyama is his latest book, Love Where You Live, Creating Emotionally Engaging Places. Great conversation, Peter. Thanks very much for taking a few minutes.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with an author who remembers growing up in Dodge City, Kansas. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back, and I am Steve Kraske. Yesterday, the smart money experts discussed how to break up with bad financial habits like financial procrastination and inertia. You can find that conversation and many more at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, in light of national conversations, the Children's Health Panel will tackle how to keep our kids safe from sexual abuse. They'll also share tips and signs for recognizing eating disorders. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Robert Rabin works in academia now, but his upbringing in western Kansas still has a powerful hold on him. In a new collection of essays, Rabin recalls stock car drivers and rounding up runaway cattle. He remembers the kid he had to fight in high school to preserve his honor, and a sad story of an uncle damaged by Vietnam who never had much of a chance at making it when the war was over. Robert Rabin recalls all of this in his new book, Headlights on the Prairie, Essays on Home. He's chair of the English department at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He speaks at the library tomorrow night. And Robert, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you've made a life in a very different place and doing very different things than what you grew up with on the high plains of western Kansas and out in Dodge City. Does that suggest that maybe you had had enough?
No, I think it suggests that I was raised to live about any kind of life you want to live or any kind of life you could find yourself in. The fact is that people who were raised in western Kansas the way that I was raised spread out across the country to do all kinds of jobs. I have a good friend of mine I went to high school with. He's a CEO of a company here in Kansas City. You know, I joke in my book, Dragon Wide Earp, that children in western Kansas are in part raised for export.
Mm-hmm. To do something else, eh? You know, many of these stories that you tell here are in, you know, pretty direct, straightforward way. There's not a lot of nostalgia attached to them. How much do you miss western Kansas?
I miss it quite a lot, but I also get back quite a bit. So my family and I are in a unique position that we can go back and visit where I grew up without staying with anyone. My parents have maintained a separate house on the 4,000-acre cattle ranch that they have. So we're able to go back several times a year, stay there for a whole week, ride horses, visit with my parents.
Wow.
And yeah, it's been a great thing.
This isn't your first book that's set on the High Plains, as you just mentioned. What do you find ultimately that's so fascinating about the place?
Well, you know, I think when you're growing up in a place, you're an insider to it. You really don't have any perspective. It's just the world that you know. And I grew up in Dodge City, and with the exception of a couple of trips to Kansas City, maybe one to Dallas, one to Denver, I really didn't leave Western Kansas until I left to go to college. And then from there, I studied abroad in England. I lived in North Africa for a while. I lived in New York State. And these experiences make you realize the thing that just seemed like regular life and run-of-the-mill to you when you were growing up actually has a lot of unique qualities to it. And I think I now have kind of maintained or developed a sort of insider/outsider perspective where I know what's going on there because I spent a lot of time there and I grew up there, but I can also see from the outside the things about it that are unique and interesting.
What do you think you got out of the experience that maybe a kid in Kansas City doesn't get?
Well, here's one example. Many people, and I write about this in the book, about teaching my daughter how to drive in a chapter called Driver's Education. The way I was taught to drive was this. I was riding in a pickup with my dad. I was about 9 years old. We had two huge bulls loaded into the back of a trailer that we were pulling out in the middle of the country in western Kansas. One of the bulls got out over the top of the trailer and took off. And as my dad watched the bull kind of heading cross country, he gave me a quick lesson on how to drive. And then I had to track him and follow him in that pickup, pulling that bull on a dirt road. That's the kind of thing that happens out there quite a lot. My brother Dave started flying airplanes when he was 13 years old with my Uncle Harold, who had learned in the military.
And flying solo not long afterwards, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Which is just amazing.
Yeah, and I think it's the way you grow up out there, it's necessary. I remember the first time I saw a kid get out of a pickup and had straps around his feet that had like blocks of wood on the bottom of them, and it was because during the harvest he needed to not drive a truck on the highway, but to move it back and forth to where the people were taking him away.
So what were the things on his feet about?
So he could reach the pedals.
Oh, just that simple, eh?
Yeah.
There are so many good stories in this book. Tell us about the fight and this kid, Lester Gutches.
Yeah, that's not his real name. I changed the name in that particular story once I saw that he's on Facebook, and I didn't want to kind of call him out. But
he was after you for no good reason back in the day.
Yeah, I had an interesting childhood in the sense that I went to a Catholic grade school, first grade through eighth grade, and in those days, junior high was seventh, eighth, and ninth, and high school started sophomore year. So those of us who went to this little Catholic school all the way through eighth grade, we had to then blend in with and join the public school kids for 1 year in junior high. And so there was a lot of drama surrounding that. The feeling was that we were coming over to take positions on the football team, possibly girlfriends.
Yes. And what happened with Lester?
Well, he announced early on, I didn't know who he was. I had never heard of his name.
But he wanted to get a piece of you, didn't he?
Well, yeah. He announced early on that, you know, he had already beaten up everybody in that school, but now there were some new kids. And I don't know who said this, but probably somebody I went to school with said, well, the toughest one coming over from our little school is Rabine, so go after him.
So what happened? Because you were prepared for your encounter with him because you knew it was coming.
Right. So it's not something I'm particularly proud of, but I got myself
oh, sure
ready.
We are.
and when the fight broke out, I had a little plan. I kind of tapped him on his shin to stun him a little bit, and then I hit him in the face.
You busted his nose.
Broke his nose, yeah.
But who cares about that now, right?
Right. Yeah.
And then he came after you again. And what struck me about the second incident, you're at a football game with your girlfriend, and you've been really concerned about sort of maintaining your honor with her as she watched this drama unfold. And you're sitting at a football game, and Lester brings a knife, and he's sort of poking it in your ribs, and that was a little disturbing. This is a kid who might do some serious damage.
Well, and that's what all the kids who knew him really well kept saying to me is that you don't understand. There's some really bad things that can happen. But, you know, it's kind of an anti-fight story in a way because with the exception of that one punch that was thrown, nothing else happened. It was a lot of adolescent kind of posturing and negotiating and trying to see if we could both get out of this situation with some kind of honor intact without having to do more than that.
Robert Rabine is my guest. His new book, Headlights on the Prairie, Essays on Home, it's about his upbringing in the Dodge City area. Then there was your encounter with open-wheel jalopies and the races that your brother took part in. Describe one of these races for us, because you do a great job of describing. There's just all this dirt and smoke and noise, and it's more than any human should have to endure.
Yeah, it's the nature of dirt track racing. Anybody who's gone out and watched sprint cars, stock cars that are racing on banked ovals. So these are clay tracks. They're usually 3/8 of a mile to 1/2 mile. And once those cars get going around that track, the dirt and the dust flies. I mean, true fans, and this is true in Indiana too, where I live now, they want to get as close to the track as they can, and they'll actually wear plastic goggles to keep the to keep the smoke and the mud out of their face. But this was a culture that I grew up in. My dad and his brother had built cars starting back in the 1950s, and then my brother became very heavily involved with it the year that he graduated from high school.
And then one night there's this race, and things are going on, and it's getting the dust cloud is greater than it's ever been before, and then something horrible happens.
Yeah, it's probably the worst accident on a racetrack in the history of the state of Kansas. It happened at the Kansas State Fair in 1974.
In Hutch, right?
Yeah, in Hutchinson.
Yeah.
And in those days, they didn't have the same kind of rules that we have now. So there were drivers driving in that race. It was a very hot day, probably 100 degrees. There were drivers driving that race who didn't have on a fire suit, didn't have on a fire mask, didn't have fire gloves.
It was too hot.
Yeah, and they weren't required to wear them. And then there were drivers driving cars that didn't have a fuel cell. And so when the smoke got going and the visibility got bad.
And you're sitting there and your mom and dad are thinking, this is getting bad.
Yeah, you could almost feel it coming. Actually, the conditions were so bad, the race probably should not have been run.
Right.
Because the wreck happened only on like the third lap. By the third, it was supposed to be a 50-lap race, and by the third lap, the drivers couldn't see anything. And so when there was a pileup right underneath the flag station, we just watched the cars drive all the way around the track, and they couldn't see anything and drive right into that pile. And a big fire.
Big explosion. Yeah,
big explosion.
How did it change your family's attitude toward these open-wheel jalopy races?
Well, I think it made us realize that all of the time and attention my father had put into safety, which when I was, I was a young kid when I was watching this, I didn't think it was very cool. But afterwards, I realized why he had done it. My brother had one of the safest cars on the track. Thankfully, nobody died in that wreck. There were a lot of guys who were taken to burn centers and had a lot of serious damage, but all of them went back to racing, and I think that's just the way it is out there. You go right back to it.
I was going to say, I mean, has Western Kansas changed all that much? I mean, do kids today have similar experiences that the same ones that Robert Rabine had growing up?
Well, there was no internet back then, so that's the big difference, but I think it's a lot the same now as it was back then. Families are a little bit smaller. There's more access to the outside world through the internet and cable television. But when you walk out the door, you're still living out there. And to live out there, you got to kind of bring your A game.
You tell such a poignant story of your Uncle Scott, a Vietnam vet who struggled for years and then ultimately didn't make it. You were just in fourth grade one year, Robert, when your mother took you to the big city, this was Wichita, for a health test for yourself. And then she took you to visit Uncle Scott. And for a fourth grader, and that's how you tell this story through the eyes of this fourth grader, it's an eye-opener for you.
Yeah, and that's kind of a strategy that I use throughout the book. The book is organized. There are 12 essays in it, and the early essays start with me being, I think the first one, I'm 8, 10 years old. And then by the last one, I'm really writing about my life today. Mm-hmm. But in thinking about that memory, I really do remember it and see it through the eyes of a 10-year-old. And So, there were a lot of adult things going on around me, adult conversations, things that I couldn't understand. And so when you read the essay, you have to see it through my eyes, But then hopefully, you know, you see it through your own adult eyes and you
sure
kind
you
of
do.
See what I don't can't see.
Yeah, because you were frustrated with your Uncle Scott because he just wasn't, he was different. He didn't wake up on time. You were hungry for family meals and your mom was saying, we're not eating till Uncle Scott comes. And clearly, even for your mother, he was her half brother, but still your mother's compassion for him comes through in a very clear way. She clearly was looking out for him.
She was, and I think she felt bad about the breaks that he didn't get in his life. His mother died when he was 9 years old. His father died just a few years after that. For years after that, he was kind of shuttled around between various family members. So it was a tough thing. And then her oldest children were only 3 or 4 years younger than Scott. Mm-hmm. So there were whole summers even before he came back from Vietnam where he stayed with us and he lived with us. But he was always a little bit different. And as a young child, I had a hard time understanding that because mm-hmm. I thought, this is a family. These are the rules. Got to play by them.
So you go to Wichita, and your mother is determined to go see and find Uncle Scott. And what's so interesting to me is she didn't know exactly where he lived. He'd become almost a street person at that point,
yeah.
living in an old shack at the end of a street. And you're driving up and down streets, and she's asking people, and you know, people that might make a middle-aged woman nervous, she's asking them, Scott is, and you finally find him.
Yeah, and that really, my first book had a lot of essays that concerned my father, and my father figures pretty prominently in this book too. But I really wanted to write something about my mom and try to capture her personality. And you know, she's a beautiful woman, an elegant woman, but also very, very tough. And that's the one thing that I witnessed that day, that she was determined to find him. She was not to be put off.
Yeah.
And she trusted in her own abilities, and she kind of trusted in the world, too.
Yeah, it comes through so clearly there. Absolutely. Robert Rabine, again, his new collection of essays, Headlights on the Prairie, Essays on Home. Again, he's chair of the English department at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and he'll be speaking at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. You can go online to grab a seat, 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Plaza branch, and enjoy your time in Kansas City. Sorry about the weather.
Oh, I will.
But you're used to it from Dodge City, right?
Yeah, and I live 5 years in Buffalo, so I'm used to that too.
Yeah, so you got it. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. If you missed last Tuesday's program and we talked with a musical virtuoso who has played with Dizzy Gillespie, Nina Simone, Charlie Parker, and well, you name it, you can find it at kcur.org. Tomorrow, our children's health experts return with advice for how to keep our kids safe from sexual abuse. They'll also give us warning signs for children experiencing eating disorders. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Stay safe out there, folks. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.